On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Geophysical Classification for a Munitions Response. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to quickly cover some introductory slides, and then I'm going to turn it over to our trainers from the ITRC team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the ITRC web-based document, Geophysical Classification for a Munitions Response, a Technical and Regulatory Guidance. We're going to introduce you to the guidance during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. A few housekeeping items to cover. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording the session. Trainers are controlling the slides. If you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that Clue In training page where you started today. Throughout today's training, you are welcome to send in questions using that Q&A box in the lower right. We'll answer some of the questions right away, but most questions we're going to hold into our question and answer breaks. We'll have one in the middle and another at the end of today's training. At the end of the class, we do look for you to fill out the feedback form. If you need confirmation, a certificate for attending today's class, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit the feedback form, that's going to generate a certificate for you. And right now, the only way to get that is by completing the feedback form. More information about ITRC is available on the website, itrcweb.org. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents. We have our schedule for the rest of 2018 available for training classes. There's also more opportunity to become more involved in ITRC, so I encourage you to visit the website. On slide 5 at the bottom, we have a link where you can read the trainer bios. Our trainers today were all members of the ITRC team. Fred Riemann is retired from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. We have Dean Keysweater with Acorn Science and Innovation. Ed Walker at the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, Ed Coral at NAVC Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office, and Herb Nelson at CERTIP ESTCP. I'll now turn the presentation over to Fred Riemann from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Well, thanks, Juliana. We're going to actually start off here with a video that demonstrates what's being cleaned up. To hear the munitions exploding on this video, you need to be listening to your computer speakers, so go ahead and turn those on now if you joined us on the phone. So go ahead and start that video, Julia. This video shows you how metal is scattered all over a training range. You see the explosion? And that's a lot of stuff flying around. So my next slides are going to sort of define the problem for you. Our soldiers need to train for combat and test their weapons. Some of those rockets and shells, when they get fired, they don't blow up and end up buried in the ground out on the range. They're still explosive and very dangerous. And then years later, we need to clean those sites up on live fire ranges. As you saw that tank blowing up, there's going to be thousands of pieces of scrap metal like you see in the graphic on the left, and maybe just a few live pieces of ordnance that didn't go off. For a long time, we've used single-axis sensors, and ITRC has been developing with the Department of Defense training and guidance on using those for over 10 years. You can see in this photo, this is a sea of flags, we call it. It was discovered by single-axis sensors. Thousands of pieces of metal detected below ground. And On a typical single-axis sensor scan, all of those pieces are located and then dug up. Well, cleaning up these munitions on all these sites is a big job. There's about 5,200 sites all over America. Half of them are going to need some kind of geophysical investigation. DOD realized really early on that if we rely on that single-axis sensor, it's going to cost us billions of dollars, and we won't be done with it until the next century. So I'm going to call up the first two pole pods, if we could, Julianne. Before we started, we had these two polls on the screen. You can still vote now. Right up until the end here, we see from the results here that if you do have munitions response experience, you've probably got some knowledge with geophysical classification by now. We've been doing this for several years. So I'm glad to see that we've got a little bit of experience, but a lot of you don't have any experience with this newer technology, and that's what we're trying to get across here, is how to find the guidance to use the technology. So let's start out with telling you a little bit about the comparison between the two technologies. The multi-axis sensors have several advantages. You can go ahead and drop those poles now if you want. We've seen those. We can figure out whether the object is the size and shape of a munitions item, and then we can make decisions to dig only munitions-like items, and we can safely leave non-munitions items in the ground. The digging that we do at a site is significantly reduced, and of course it allows us to cover much more area at a lower cost and with less disruption for the landowner. As you listen to the presenters, you're going to hear some new terminology. We sent out a sheet in the introductory materials with many of the terms that you might be unfamiliar with, so from here on you may want to have that sort of in front of you. So here's our definition of geophysical classification, but these pictures really tell it better than the words do. So we can tell from the data collected by our newer multi-axis sensors whether an item in the ground is bomb-like, like the shell on the left, or non-hazardous frag, like the scrap of metal on the right. We classify the scrap metal on the right as not being a target of interest based on the scan, because the scanners can tell us with certainty that it's not a bomb. It doesn't look like one, so we won't have to dig it up. Here you can see a few more targets. We found these by investigating what are called anomalies. They're usually caused by metal objects encountered in our geophysical scan. It's just an anomaly, something that's different than the normal background at that site. And here's the decisions that we make on each one of those anomalies. The new multi-axis sensors allow us to make dig and no-dig decisions based on whether we classify an object as a target of interest. Our acronym for that is TOI, so you'll hear that a few times. So TOI goes on a dig list, and non-TOI, like the frag and horseshoes that you see here, get left in the ground. Compared to using a single-axis sensor, you can see without this technology, we would have dug up the horseshoe and the scrap metal. And since 80% or more of the metal at old training sites is scrap metal, like that blown-up tank you saw, we'd have done a lot of unnecessary and also very expensive digging at that site. We're going to show you some real-world examples of how classification works. The technology development for these sensors was an intensive 10-year program. Then they were tested at many sites across the country. We've been deploying them for a few years now. Early results were really promising, and we realized early on that the trick is rigorous process control and quality control is critical to deploying the new technology. Today, we've documented several cleanups where successful implementation was demonstrated, and links to those demonstration projects where we dug up everything to see if we got it all are provided in the guidance document. Again, remember to keep the glossary of terms in front of you. I'm going to show you results from some of the demonstration sites. And a few of the underlying terms here are going to be used actually on the next slides. So here's an actual demonstration site where single-axis sensors were actually compared to using multi-axis sensors. This geophysical mapping was done with a single-axis sensor. That technology just finds all the metal, and you need to dig it up to figure out what it is or even how deep it's buried. In this area, more than 5,000 metal objects were detected that needed to be excavated. 16 of those were found to be hazardous, which is what we were looking for. So you can see here, out of 5,000 pieces, most of the items detected by our sensors were actually non-hazardous items. Moving to another site at Camp Cyber, the Defense Department used geophysical classification, using this type of a sensor behind that tractor. Over 6,000 items were detected, and using single-axis sensors, we would have dug them all up. Using the new technology, the metal mapper you see there behind the tractor, the software analysis told us that we really only had to dig less than 10% of those. We dug 16% of the most likely to be bomb-like ones, just to be sure, and we blind-seeded hundreds of dummy items. These are called QA seeds to test the sensors and the process, to make sure that we're following the process and getting every one of those. And we found every one of those seeds. The contractor also seeds items every day for quality control. We call those QC seeds. In the process, at this particular site, they found 3 actual explosive mortars, which, of course, that's what they were looking for. Just to be sure about our decisions at this site, we dug up another 200 unique targets, plus another 400 more of the targets that were classified as clutter. This was to validate the technology, to be sure that nothing was left there that was not classified correctly. All of those quality assurance efforts told us that the technology had correctly selected which items needed to be dug. Okay, so here's why you want to know about the new technology. With a multi-axis sensor, you'll do a little more scanning and a lot more analysis, but you'll do a whole lot less digging on your site, and you'll probably have even more confidence that you got all the unexploded ordnance. You won't be able to use this on every site you have. Ed Walker is going to tell you about some of the limitations, but you will learn that anywhere you might use a single-axis sensor, these new multi-axis sensors will do as well or better, and probably for less expense. The new technology is going to significantly reduce costs. You'll see this slide again later. You'll learn that we focus a lot more on the surveys, engineering, computers, quality control, things like that, but the overall cost savings will amount to billions of dollars overall. Most of the cost savings is from not having our EOD guys digging up hundreds of thousands of horseshoes and blown-up tank parts. So I'm a state regulator from Alaska. At least I was until I retired, yay. And I approve cleanups of munitions response sites. When I went to my first meeting with some of the people you're going to hear next, I was actually skeptical of the technology. So I'm sure a lot of you also will have questions, especially if you're regulators like I was. My first question was, does the technology work, of course? And that's followed by, is it ready to deploy? What are its limitations? How do I make sure of my decisions? Leaving any metal behind in the ground is a scary thing, so I needed to be sure whatever was not dug up really is just clutter, like the sensors say that it is. Our team tackled those questions and provided answers in the web-based guidance document and in this training. The roles for the contractors, stakeholders, state and federal regulators, Department of Defense guys, and the managers are outlined pretty clearly in the guidance. The team studied the results and watched the demonstrations. And this whole team believed when we released this guidance that the technology is ready to deploy. The guidance is web-based, and it's easy to use. I encourage you to go to the website, review the guidance, review some of the case studies, and contact one of us if you have questions about them. The site's really quite easy to read, and as you can see here, since it's web-based, we were able to make it even easier by having definitions and concepts pop up to help you with unfamiliar terms and concepts. Key decision points for your cleanup team, where I put green arrows on this slide, are covered in the guidance. The presenters you'll hear next are all part of this ITRC team. Our goal at ITRC is to break down regulatory barriers to using new technologies. And to do that, we get regulators, Defense Department guys, consultants, even some of the quality guys from the chemistry group, all in one room. We evaluated the technology, and we're here today telling you that it's ready to use. We developed a bunch of tools, wrote fact sheets, advised DOD on a certification program where people are going to be deploying this, wrote a web-based guidance, and even put together a template project plan that'll help you manage projects at your site. Today we're going to show you the software and the sensor hardware technology, explain to you a little bit about how it works, that is used to classify objects as possibly hazardous, a TOI, or non-hazardous, non-TOI. We're going to show you how those decisions are made and how they're validated on each of these thousands of metal objects. You'll learn some of the limitations of the technology. We'll go into some detail about quality controls necessary for successful implementation. I started you on the terminology and the acronyms, and we'll do more of that throughout the training. It's going to give you enough of an introduction so you can discuss the technology intelligently with your coworkers, stakeholders, and the people responsible for cleaning up the sites. We're pointing you to our guidance document so you can access the tools you need when you evaluate classification for your sites. My role as a state regulator on this team was to evaluate the deployment of the technology and develop a process with these experts from the Defense Department that other state regulators could have confidence in. After today, we hope you're going to be comfortable with the thought that by following this rigorous approach using these multi-axis sensors, we can safely leave some metal items in the ground after correctly classifying them as non-hazardous. Tools, links, technical information you'll learn about are summarized in that web-based guidance document. And after the training today, you'll know where to go to look for the information you need to make those decisions at your site. So I'm here as a state regulator telling you I'm comfortable that this technology works and you can use it to figure out what needs to be dug up at your site. So now we're going to hear more from the experts. Dean from Acorn Science and Innovation will step you through how the technology works.
All right, thank you, Fred. So I want to start, I guess, with this sea of flags that Fred showed. This survey is from a previous survey, non-classification survey, and each of those flags represent locations at which metallic objects are beneath the ground. And as Fred pointed out by his examples, we know historically that almost all of these items, if not all of them, are clutter or pieces of ordnance that were busted upon explosion or tanks or things. And because we have to dig them up, it's expensive. So if we only knew which ones to dig up, we could avoid all these extra digs. And that's really the key of this. And we're going to find out today that we can, in fact, determine which ones to dig up. We can use something called electromagnetic induction sensors and their data to determine which ones to dig up. And today, in the next few minutes, 15 or 20, I guess, I'm going to kind of step through some of these sensors, and we'll look to see how it is done. All right, so the outline for this section is really threefold. One, we want to look at, you know, how the sensors work and what they look like. I gave you a preview there on the picture on the right. Secondly, we wanted to look at how we utilize the acquired data. Do we just use the data as it comes in, or do we do something with it? And thirdly, once we're kind of happy with what we have, how do we make a decision? What's that decision process? The concepts, electromagnetic and stuff, and the idea of a sensor may seem technical and probably unfamiliar to most of us. So I want to look at perhaps an analogy that we are familiar with to kind of prepare us for the description of the sensors. And the analogy I want to use is that of echolocation. So this, of course, is used by dolphins and bats. They utilize acoustic waves to locate objects by reflected sound. And at a high level, they do essentially three things. One, the dolphin or the bat will generate a pulse, and this pulse will travel out in space. It interacts with the object, which is the second thing, and then it detects a third. The third piece is it detects something. And so it detects the scattered response. So the dolphin sends out a pulse, a pressure wave. The target interacts with that pressure wave. The dolphin then receives that secondary response, and by doing this over and over and over repeatedly and kind of as a function of time, they figure out where the fish is going and they go eat them. So, of course, we're not going to eat fish, but we are interested in kind of these three simple schemes. So with regards to electromagnetic, the source that we generate, the excitation pulse, is a time-varying magnetic field. So in the case of the echolocation, they use pressure fields. We use a time-varying magnetic field. Of course, you can't feel or sense a magnetic field, but they are, in fact, real. And we generate these by using a loop of wire called a transmit coil, and we run current through that wire. And so that's how this time-varying magnetic field is set up. This time-varying magnetic field propagates through space, and if there are targets in the vicinity, they interact with it. And currents are induced in that metallic objects, and it in turn produces a secondary magnetic field. This is the induced target response. It is essentially the interaction of the metallic piece with our primary field that we generated. The third piece then is for us to listen to it, for us to hear this secondary magnetic field, and we do that with another loop of wire we call a receive coil, and so we measure the magnetic flux through the receive coil, and in this way we sense the presence of a metallic object. What we actually record are voltages that the time-varying magnetic field through that receive coil produces a voltage that decays as a function of time. And so we listen to that time decay, and we try to make sense of it that way. So this is essentially what the sensor is doing, and we record a bunch of these transients in order to make our decisions. Here, of course, I'm only showing one transmit coil, one receive coil, and one object. In reality, there can be lots of them. I might also mention that this time, that scale that I have shown on the right, is actually measured in milliseconds, somewhere between 3 and 30 milliseconds, and a milli is a thousandth of a second. So this thing happens very, very fast, and we do stack them. We do record many, many of them. So in a sense, I've shown you how they're similar, right? How the two analogies are similar, but here's a way they're different, and it's kind of your chance to shine, because we're going to ask you a question here. But so using echolocations, dolphins can detect a small sphere a long ways off, 70 meters off. How far can we see that same sphere? How far can electromagnetics detect this sphere? So if you just put pen to paper here, we'll take a quick little poll, and then we'll see the answer. All righty. I see a lot of responses coming in. I guess the majority is over 10 meters, and a few are less than a meter. I'm going to end it here just in the interest of time. I appreciate your response. But the answer is actually very short. These sensors are, in fact, very nearsighted. We can't see very far. The electromagnetic response is inversely proportional to the distance to the sixth power. So this thing decays very fast. And as a result, to make use of these sensors, we have to get them close to the source that we're interested in. We have to get them close to the ground. And there are a couple ways, and I'm just going to introduce them here. Later, they'll be discussed a bit in a bit more detail. But here I've plotted space, so X and Y, eastings and northings. And each little dot represents kind of a sample that we've taken. And so you can imagine, like, you're mowing the grass, you're trying to cover the space with the sensor, because you want to keep it close to the ground, and we want to cover the entire space. So that's one method of data collection. Another method is where, by hook or crook, we know we have an idea where the buried items are. And so we just simply go sit on those, and we collect what's called cued measurements. And so both of these things work. The reason I'm showing them, though, is because what we're going to discuss next is that the things that happen at the sensor, when the sensor collects data, is true for both cases. So no matter which way you acquire the data, what we're going to talk about happens during that, tens of milliseconds, or up to a second if you stack them, period during which you're taking measurements, actually taking measurements. All right, so this is what a few of the the advanced EMI sensors look like. These are prototype sensors, meaning they were developed by the research community over that 10-year period. And they're, you know, they're made for a few different deployments. On the left hand is a person portable one. I'd point out that the sensor itself is this hand, it looks like a, you know, a thick metal detector. The electronics is to the left. There's also a cart-mounted version in the middle, a little bit bigger. Again, the operator has, you know, a computer on his back with some heavy batteries and some big umbilical cords, and the sensor is a little bit bigger, but it still, you know, can be advanced by a person. And on the right, there are vehicle tilt sensors. So there's different ranges of these sensors that have been designed, but they all are common in the sense that they use multiple transmit and receive coils to get to record and measure the complete response of the item. So all of these sensors use a fixed geometry. These coils are glued in place. They're buried within these structures. And they all use multiple coils to look at the transients. So we're going to step through just using the middle sensor, this cart-mounted version, and take a look at what actually is recorded and how we use it. So the picture on the right, again, this is reference for you to see what it looks like. And the diagram on the upper left-hand corner, the black rectangle represents simply the outline of the sensor. This thing is kind of square and pancake-like. The red squares are each transmitter coils. So there are four transmit coils in this particular sensor. And there's nothing magic about this sensor. I'm just using it as an example. Inside those transmitter coils are these things that look like a little Christmas present, but it's actually a receive cube. Each of those cubes has three receive coils. We use all of these coils to illuminate or light up the object. And so what I mean by that is if we energize transmit coil one, we record the measurement of all three receive coils. But we also receive and measure and log the measured induced transients in the second, the receive coils in transmitter two, and in three, and in four. And so with one transmit pulse, we listen to multiple geometries in multiple planes of in space. And this is what we mean by when we light up, we illuminate the object, we look at it in different planes. So I want to continue that idea and look to see how the measured data are essentially affected by burial depth and object orientation and see kind of how we overcome it in the next few slides. So I've shown here the data that we saw in the previous slide. We don't only transmit with transmitter one, we also use transmitter two. We record the same exact set of data with it, the same with three, and the same with four. So, and this cycle is repeated over and over and over. So you can see that we receive a lot of transients, a lot of information. The reason we do that is if we now watch the measured data as the object is moved in space relative to our transmit and receive coils. So the diagram in the upper right kind of shows you where the object is relative to the coils. You'll see that the data change. Which is kind of alarming, right? Because we're trying to measure something about this target, and we find that it is a function of burial depth and orientation. So the picture is changing. However, in our case, it's changing in a predictable way, and we can make use of that. So if we look at the next slide here, we have the process that's used to make use of it, and we take the data that are measured by the sensor, and we run them through a mathematical model that derives what I'm generally referring to here as the EMI response. And it takes the signatures, and it divides them into two buckets of information. One has the location and orientation of the object, so it gives us the orientation and the location of the object relative to the coils. And the second thing is it gives us these polarizabilities. Polarizabilities are intrinsic to the target. They are not affected by burial depth and orientation. So this is what we want. This is the fingerprint. This is going to tell us something about the object. So if we go back to our previous example, the data on the left are the same thing I showed before. The polarizabilities on the right are the derived polarizabilities that have come out of that mathematical model. And you'll see that even though the measurements change, the polarizabilities remain the same. And so this is key, fundamental and key to trying to make a decision about using electromagnetic data. We have to use the polarizabilities. And you'll also see that all that information on the left has been summarized in these three curves on the right. And mathematically speaking, they're kind of point dipoles that are orientated along the body of the object. So there's three responses. One is larger and generally it corresponds with the long axis of the item. And there are two smaller ones, which for UXO happen to be uniform and smaller. So we have polarizations that we derive. It turns out that we're not used to looking at polarizations, all right? We're used to looking at properties of objects. And it turns out that the object's properties do relate into polarizability properties. The cylindrical shape of the item corresponds to the axial symmetry. The thickness of the walls of the item, of the UXO, are revealed by the rate of decay of our polarizabilities, and the physical size is by the magnitude. So these are kind of three simple but very important properties that we use to kind of make sense of this thing. So first, if we look at the property of shape, on the left, so UXO are usually axisymmetric, and clutter can be axisymmetric, but usually they're not. And so if we look at the one on the left, which is for UXO, I'm going to highlight the three polarizabilities in red, the primary and the green and the blue are the secondary and tertiary. On the left-hand side, because the object is symmetric, the polarizabilities, the second and third polarizabilities are equal to each other. For non-UXO, which is the case for clutter, they are variable in shape, but oftentimes not asymmetric. The asymmetry produces second and tertiary polarizabilities that are not equal. And so this is kind of an easy way to tell that we have the presence of clutter as opposed to something that looks like a target of interest or UXO. The second property we can look at is wall thickness. And thick-walled metals decay slower than thin-walled debris and clutter, thin-walled metal. On the left-hand side is a UXO with thick walls and a little bit longer decay. On the right is clutter, which has variable wall thickness, but typically it's thinner, and it oftentimes exhibits a much faster decay. So this decay is kind of like a bell ringing. You can hear how long it holds the energy. This isn't really acoustic ringing. It's more electrical currents that are diffusing. But nevertheless, the longer it holds the energy, the thicker the walls, and we kind of think that it may be more substantial. The third property we can look at that's really easy is the size. So again, UXO are variable in size. Some are small, like 20 millimeters, and some are very large, like 155s or even larger bombs, 155 millimeters. But often they're larger than the fragments. The non-UXO, again, are variable in size, but oftentimes the majority are small. And so if we look at the amplitude of the polarizabilities, in this case I'm pointing to the amplitude of the primary polarizability, you can see that the larger the size, larger the volume of the object, the larger the magnitude of the polarizability. So this is kind of how we use these polarizabilities to infer things about the object's shape. So we just went through the data, we looked at the data, and we derived polarizations, and now we kind of know what the sensor sees when it sees a metallic object, but we don't necessarily know what to do with it. And because of that, we need a library. And so this is a collection of signatures of it's an empirical collection of signatures that we've simply went out and collected. And it includes metadata, sensor data, which is the transients, but also the polarizations, like the key here, of a bunch, lots and lots of UXO types. And we use this library then in conjunction with the measured transients and polarized abilities over the unknown objects to make a decision. So now we're going to move into the decision process. We've looked at what is being measured. We looked at the fact that we need to process it and kind of, you know, at a high level talked about how we process it. We now know what we are looking for. So how do we characterize it and what do we do? So our objective now is to prioritize the sources. We want to compare these unknown sources to that in our library and make a decision. There are three ways to essentially be classified as a library item. One is simply to look like an item in the library. So this is like T-ball in a home run situation. If the unknown object looks just like our library item, we say dig it. A second way is to be part of a cluster. And here we're realizing that our library is not 100% complete. And there may be objects that are not in our library, but we want to find them anyways. And so we look for items that are similar to a lot of its neighbors, but that are unexplained by the library. And then we go do something with those. The third way is to be simply big and deep. And this simply reflects upon the fact that the clutter is usually shallow, and there are not a lot of big metallic things deeply buried. And if they are, we probably should investigate them. So we do. I want to look at these first two just real quickly here. I want to show you graphically, visually, how we compare the signatures. So on the left-hand figure there, in the colored dash lines, I have the signature, the polarized abilities for an unknown object. In the gray, I have the from the library polarized abilities for a 37 millimeter target. We can just, we can see that our target is too large to be a 37. Right? It's a little bit wrong shape, but it's also too large. Similarly, we can compare our measured data and our polarized abilities to a signature for a 105 millimeter. And here, of course, we see that it's too small. So this is kind of, you know, kind of like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears approach, visually speaking. And if we do it again and we happen to compare it against a 75 millimeter projectile, it looks just right and we like it and we sleep there. So we did this visually and kind of slow. The computer actually does it, you know, thousands and thousands of times a second, and it's very fast, and it's numerical in nature. So these things all end up having a score, a metric match of how similar the unknown item is to the item in our library. So by this method, we would say that we like this target, we think it's this target, and it looks just like it, so you should dig it. Sometimes let me step back just a bit. So sometimes the objects look like their neighbors, and we call these clusters. So when they're groups of items with similar response, they are called clusters. I've shown two closed clusters here, one the 155 millimeter match on the left and an ISO match on the right. And most of the time, the items are in our library, and they are well explained by the library. So in this particular case, the unknown signature is in blue, the library is in red, and all of its neighbors are in gray, and everything is kind of explained, and it's nice. And so we would dig these. Sometimes there are clusters that do not match anything in the library. And so to be safe, we excavate some of them, and then proceed accordingly. And in this particular case, there was a bunch of items at one of the demonstration sites that happened to be, you know, after digging them up, a number of them up, we realized that they were all T-bar fuses. They were determined by the project team to be non-hazardous, and so we did not add them to the library, and we did not recommend that these objects be removed by excavation. Once our library is complete, we essentially rank all of those by that metric match that I described, and we simply start digging at the top. And and we dig all of them, and we confirm that the recovered items do in fact match our predictions. So in this way, this essentially is a high level view of how the data are collected and processed and analyzed and put in a dig sheet. In reality, as you'll find out later, we also dig a bunch of those in the do not dig category for quality control purposes, but that will be explained in later sections. And so that's all I have now about the sensors. So, you know, we've looked at the sensors at a high level, and now we know how essentially this, you know, in general, the decisions are made. So with that, I'll pass it off to Ed to move on and talk about the site suitabilities.
Thanks, Dean. Okay, so now that we know a lot about how this technology works, let's take a look and see if it will work at our site or what sites it will work at. But I want to take a little step back and just reemphasize that these new sensors are fundamentally the same as traditional sensors. And then we'll also look at the site characterization that's required to know if this technology is going to work. And we're going to look at the remedial action objective and see if our site has an achievable remedial action objective. We'll take a look at the operational environment, the terrain, or the area that these pieces of equipment can work in. And then we'll briefly talk about how to get the team ready for geophysical classification. So to go back a bit here, Dean gave us a great discussion on the sensors and the technology. But if you're familiar with traditional single-axis sensors, then you're going to be familiar with the site requirements for these multi-axis sensors. And I'm going to reemphasize what Fred said, that if the single-axis sensors worked at your site, then these multi-axis sensors will probably work and will probably do a better job. And so we'll just take a quick look at one of these traditional sensors, an EM61, and Dean went through the whole discussion of how this coil creates a field and interacts with the targets. And so you have that traditional sensor on the left. Well, on the right, we have these new sensors, and they just, like Dean said, they have more coils, but fundamentally they act very similar. So to determine whether or not this is going to work, you're going to need a well-developed conceptual site model. And through the development of this technology and projects throughout the years, it's been realized that the performance that these crews have is directly tied into how well their site characterization was. Some of the most important things to have in your site characterization can be summarized in a conceptual site model, or CSM. And that would be the land use, how this property will be used in its foreseeable future. We'll also want to know where the historic ranges were, the munitions response sites. You know, so you may have historical information that identifies what type of munitions were used where. And we'd also want to know as much as we can about the munition type and depth, or munition types that were used, and potentially how deep they could go into the subsurface, as well as having this previous work summarized is very important. And then also all decisions that have been made or are in the process of being made for how the site will be used in the future. Kind of a recent and more used idea is using this vertical conceptual site model, and it really summarizes a ton of information in a very, very succinct picture. And that is summarizing the munitions types that we expect at the site, as well as if we do have information on how deep they were recovered, if any previous work has been done. That's real important. But also having the sensor's capabilities, how deep that sensor can detect ammunition. So the stars show the recovery depths that we know. The dotted line shows how deep the sensor can detect the item, and then we have all the munitions types listed on the bottom. Really, really important to see that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But that's going to help us develop an achievable remedial action objective. And so we're going to determine whether or not these sensors or this technology can be used at the site. And to do that, we want to have a clear expectation from the stakeholders regarding what targets of interest we have. And we're gonna base that on the munitions that were known or expected to be on the site. And the important thing to know is to have experts on your team that know how those munitions would have been used or the operational history of the site. And that could be very important because, number one, we want to know how deep these things could go. And then also, are there hazardous components that could be expected to be sub-pieces of the munitions, you know, fragments or fuses or something that may be hazardous? And Dean talked a lot about that. And the reason that's so important is because if you see the center T-bar fuse that Dean was talking about, if you have a bunch of those out there and they are hazardous and they're the same size as some of the fragments, then we're going to have a hard time telling which the dangerous stuff from the non-dangerous stuff. So if we can get the site team to agree that those T-bar fuses that are not hazardous, we're not going to be digging those up, and we can focus on the more hazardous stuff. So it's important to get your team together on that. Another point is that multiple distinct small pieces of metal that are similar in size to a target of interest, such as this 37-millimeter item on the left, if that 37-millimeter on the left is the same size as the little pieces of debris on the right, we may have some problems classifying. So, you know, in that case, you may have to weigh the benefit of using the technology if it can't tell the difference between these two items. So more discussion on our remedial action objective. It's important to understand that these EMI sensors do not consistently detect deeply buried items, and Dean talked about that. The signal strength drops rapidly as the item gets further and further away from the sensor. So it's important to take a look at this vertical conceptual site model again and determine what is our detection depth. And fortunately, a lot of time has been spent developing these response curves on the right to determine just how well these sensors can detect or how deeply they can detect munition items. And as you see on this vertical conceptual model, the dotted lines indicate how deeply we can detect these items. And in this case, we're looking pretty good. You know, based on the historic information, most of the munitions are well above that detection depth. So we can develop an objective of removing all munitions of the site because we can see that we are likely to detect them at their expected depths. Separate from the technology is the operation or the operational environment that you're going to be working in. There may be constraints in it that the technology just is not going to be able to overcome. New sensors have similar restraints as old sensors, so it's not something to worry about. It's just something to consider. One thing to consider is that these sensors are generally not used on airborne or in airplanes or helicopters or on underwater platforms, and that's because of the signal drops off significantly with distance away from the target, and generally when you're flying around, you want to be a little bit off the ground and not on the ground. So that's going to be a problem. Other key considerations to think about for your site is the background noise, or that's the geophysical noise, and we'll talk about that. Also, we'll look at anomaly density and see how anomalies per acre or targets per an acre can affect your performance, as well as looking at vegetation, how the vegetation can affect your ability to access the site, and terrain and slope, what kind of hazards can that inflict on your equipment and your operators. Also, we're going to look at structures and utilities and see how those can affect performance. So let's go back to geophysical noise. Geophysical noise is just essentially rocks that have a lot of metal in them. They'll respond to these sensor signals and give you a response. And if you have a lot of those rocks, it could be a problem. So you're going to probably have to know something about the site. And this conceptual site model may have that information in, but likely you'll have to go out and get some site measurements to determine whether or not that's going to be a factor. So we'll go out, you know, typically we'll go out and take a look at these sites, run the sensor across it, measure the background noise. And typically, if, you know, we have this RMS noise, or the root mean squared measurement of the noise, And we need that to be well below our detection thresholds. In this case, you know, it's like an order of magnitude below it, but, you know, something like five times is a good benchmark to look at. But your site team will take a look at that and evaluate that. So a big problem that comes up is anomaly density. So classification, the performance can be affected by that because the sensor has to be able to sit over the anomalies and detect them individually. So if you have multiple anomalies stacked on top of each other, it's going to really create a problem for the sensor. So in that case, you know, all is not lost. Traditional sensors have that same problem. So different approaches may have to be employed, and that could be, you know, scraping the site, you know, using tractors or something to remove some of the anomalies and sift them out, or do a traditional magnetometer survey and have crews pick up a bunch of the anomalies. But we're going to utilize the site records to determine whether or not this is going to be a problem or not, and we'll take a little look at that. So here's a picture of a site where some transect data was taken. So someone went out at some point and ran a metal detector at maybe 10 meters, transects at 10 meters apart, and came up with this estimate of the anomaly density. And you see in the center or in the left region of this figure, we have some pinkish-purple areas that indicate anomalies, about 4,000 or more anomalies per acre. And from experience, we know that that is going to be creating a problem of just too many anomalies under the sensor. So we're going to have to take a look at that. But you notice most of the site is looking pretty good. You know, we're looking like we're going to have some success out there. So in this case, a detection survey was performed where they go over the entire site. Every meter of the site is run over by a sensor, and we get a better map. And when we process that data, we determine, you know, we have better resolution. We see there's even a smaller area with a high anomaly density. So this is a real site out at Camp San Luis Obispo in California that was done, and they decided to go on out there and run a demonstration on this site. But we still see that portions of the site are a little too dense, so we were a little conservative. We drew a box around that, and we said, well, we'll do some other pre-treatment on that, where we might have to go out and use crews to dig up or remove all the small pieces of clutter, and then maybe possibly come back and do classification later on that. A big consideration is to look at the vegetation on the site, and that's, again, because these sensors have to be very close to the ground, so you cannot have brush in the way, and it must be removed. You also have to think about many of these sensors use very sensitive GPS, and they have to have a clear view of the sky to get good coordinates. And as well, the sensor has to be able to fit between trees or brush that can't be removed. So those are big considerations. You know, we've had sites where we've had to do considerable brush removal to get this technology to work. But that's the case with any sensor. They all need to get in there, so it's just one thing to consider. So the terrain dictates which type of sensor you're going to use. The toad sensors can generally work on slopes less than 20%, and you know, these cart sensors that you saw a picture of, well, they can go up to about 30%, but then you start getting into site safety considerations. It's actually kind of hard to push that thing over a 30% slope without it tipping over. And there are some person portable equipment that could be used for sites that are a little steeper, 30% slope or steeper possibly. Or if you have a bunch of rocks in the way, you know, or trees that you need to get around, you can use these handheld detectors to move around those. Structures and utilities can be a factor to consider. Buildings are going to definitely keep you from getting the sensor over the ground. And fences or electrical lines can be a problem. They can create their own electromagnetic fields that can interfere with your data collection. So these fences may need to be removed. You know, you can get pretty close to most of this stuff, but still you're going to have some interference with that, and that has to be considered. Lastly, we want to make sure we have a bunch of resources for our team to be comfortable with this technology. And as Fred mentioned, we had a group of state regulators and experts and federal government people involved in the teams to develop this guidance that we're doing today on the internet. And we also have an online guidance document for you to take a look at and review. ESDCP was a critical player in developing this technology, and they ran over 20 successful demonstrations across the state involving state regulators, building everyone's confidence in this technology. And then lastly, and maybe most importantly, is the quality assurance that's been put into this to assure that the data is collected in a high quality fashion. And so what was developed as an outcome of this technology is the Uniform Federal Quality Assurance Project Plan. And we're going to, Ed Correll is going to discuss that a little bit, but we're going to take a little break here and do questions and answers.
Thanks, Ed. Everyone is welcome to send in a question using the Q&A pod in the lower right. A couple of questions have come in already. Is there any advantage to performing an additional survey orthogonal to the original survey? For example, first survey is north-south, and then the second is east-west.
Yeah, this is Dean. I'll take a shot at answering that. So historically, there was the reason one might want to do that depends upon the transmit field, and the objective is to illuminate the source at lots of angles. And the original single axis sensors and sensing systems had a transmit field that was such that you could preferentially illuminate the angle at, you know, in a certain way depending upon which way you were traveling. And so initially, like 10 years ago, there was an advantage. The new multi-axis coils, the reason we use all of those transmit coils, some in planar mode, some in orthogonal angles, and all of the receive coils, is to not require that dual survey. So that requirement is no longer necessary for these new sensors.
Is the library site specific, or can it be used on multiple sites?
Yeah, this is Dean. I'll take that one again. The library is not site specific. As I mentioned, the signatures are intrinsic to the source item, and so to the degree that the source items don't change as a function of time or space, neither do the signatures. So the library that we have, you know, we've been using it for years, and at all of the sites that we've done surveys at, and that library, of course, is, you know, it's not static, it is augmented, and so if we encounter new items, you can add them. But the signatures themselves, if they are measured correctly, and the library that we use has been, they are not site-specific.
Do contractors consider their libraries proprietary?
Well, I'll take that one again, I guess. Historically, I think some did. But going forward, they really aren't allowed to, because as part of the quality control that's associated with DAGCAP, the libraries used, because they are a critical element in making the final classification decision, because they're critical, the library has to be reviewed by QA, by the government QA. And so the contractors are required to deliver the library that they use, which, if they have modified it, would contain their, you know, a site-specific library. They are required to give that, to hand that over to the Corps. So they essentially no longer can have proprietary libraries, and really there's no need for it either under the new rule.
And you said going forward with DAGCAP. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, this DADCAP is an accreditation program that that Ed Coral will, I guess, allude to a little bit, that the government set up in the past year to essentially accredit firms to do this kind of work, to do classification work. The process involves, you know, it's a heavy emphasis on quality systems. Contractors are required to have a quality system. They're required to follow an ISO standard, so an international standard on how lessons learned are captured and held going forward. And so there is a program. The government holds a program by which, you know, firms can become accredited. And the DADCAP is essentially the Department of Defense program for overseeing that larger accreditation program.
And can you clarify the term cluster? Are these items that are physically located together at the site?
They could be. Typically, they're not. I shouldn't say that. The way I use that term is simply to describe items that are similar to each other, regardless of where they're located. So if, for example, a particular munition was fired at a particular target, you know, the remnants of that object would preferentially be near that target. So they may actually be close together, but they don't have to be. It's simply a term that's used to describe objects that are physically similar to each other and are similar to each other. That's all.
Thanks. For our participants, you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. I'll also remind you at this point, if you leave before we wrap up, we are still looking for your feedback. So in the related links, the fourth item down takes you to the feedback form. You select the name feedback, and then you look down a bit, select browse too. We really do use the feedback that you provide on ITRC training classes. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you're interested in that certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form that certifies you attended. Once you submit, the form generates that certificate for you. And right now, the only way to get that certificate is by filling out the feedback form. We're out of questions for now, but you are welcome to send in questions throughout the second half of the training class using that Q&A box in the bottom right. In some cases, we'll answer you right back in that box, but other questions we're going to ask at the end of today's training class. For now, we'll continue on with the second half of the training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Ed Coral at the NAVC Laboratory Quality and Accreditation Office.
Okay, thank you very much, Juliana. I appreciate that. Of course, we all care about quality. This question is somewhat rhetorical, but the answer to this question here on slide 71 is really just a lead-in question and has been answered really by the previous speakers, and that is with the historical use of the single-axis sensors and the historical application of a mag flag and dig type of process, it's just too labor-intensive and too cost-prohibitive. So these new sensors allow us the ability to detect and classify munition items a priori so that we can remove items that might represent an explosive hazard and again, leaving the inert items behind. So why care about quality then? If these sensors are very powerful and they've been proven to work and validated to work, why do we need data quality? Well, simply stated, it's about confidence in decision making. So just like laboratory instruments that we use for chemical testing, all instruments have limitations, and they must be calibrated properly, and they must be used correctly, and we must establish and monitor processes and metrics to assess their performance and make sure that they're being used accordingly so that we can meet our project goals. So specifically, how do we increase our confidence in data quality? So here on slide 72, if we were all to take a step back for a moment from munitions and consider a typical chemical investigation, something that we're probably all a lot more familiar with. And if I were to poll the group and ask everyone to just list data quality related processes or actions or indicators that you typically use or associate with increasing your confidence in data. We would probably come up with a list that includes these items. Now, this is not a comprehensive list, but of course, you know, things that are important are things like sampling being representative and making sure that we have both accuracy and precision, of course. And what about, are we considering potential interferences, and what about detection limits? Data verification, and do we have third-party validation, and are we utilizing standard methods by trained analysts with demonstrated capabilities to use those methods? And what about the laboratory itself? Are they accredited to show that they've met minimum performance requirements? And do they have a corrective action process? And are they required to actually improve their process? So what I hope to convey to all of you over the next 20 minutes or so is that we have incorporated all these concepts and actually much more into the geophysical classification process. And these have been captured in the ITRC document. One thing that I would like to clarify real quick before we move forward, and that's clarification about quality assurance and quality control. Quality assurance is a process-oriented aspect. That is to make sure, for instance, that we're following SOPs and that we're doing proper data validation, where quality control is a product or a metric-oriented aspect. So this would be things like establishing and meeting accuracy and precision requirements. So both of these are necessary to ensure that our processes and our product goals are being planned for, they're being monitored, and they're being verified to make sure that we're properly meeting meeting our goals. So here on slide 73 are the specific quality sections in the ITRC document. Due to time limitations, I'll only be discussing a few items on those that are bolded here for subsections 4.3 and 4.4. So section 4.3 describes and cross-references a companion document, the Advanced Geophysical Classification QAP, or AGC QAP, that has been produced by the IDQTF. This document defines specific worksheets. It follows the UFP QAP format that many of you are probably familiar with, but it's tailored specifically for munitions using advanced geophysical classification tools. So, and then section 4.4 provides an overview of the accreditation program, DACAP, that Dean was just fielding. He did a very good job at fielding that question, but I'll provide some additional information on the accreditation program as well in just a moment. On slide 74, just a little bit more on the AGC QAP. So this particular training today, of course, is not a training on the AGC QAP product, but the ITRC document. And this ITRC document follows and cross-references key respective worksheets from the AGC QAP that are specific to key QAQC aspects during the investigation. So they will be cross-referenced both in this presentation today and also in the ITRC document. The AGC QAP was developed by a federal interagency work group, the IDQTF, and contains templates and also standard operating procedures for planning and completing a munitions investigation using these advanced geophysical sensors. We included, as part of that, some beta testing and lessons learned at a site in Colorado, and the document went final, about 2 years ago now, and available on the IDQTF website if you'd like to view that. Okay, so moving on, slide 75. This section in the ITRC document, the ITRC document is designed to follow the natural progression of steps of an investigation, starting, of course, with project planning. So during the initial phases of systematic planning, the entire project team, and that includes our regulatory partners, will start with building a problem statement. So 4.3.1 of the document outlines quality considerations that are initiated and documented in the very early phases of planning. And that's as specified in AGC QAP worksheets 9, 10, and 11. So worksheet 9 basically documents key decisions or of meetings and agreements by the project team, while worksheet number 10 documents the conceptual site model, and worksheet 11 documents the remaining steps of the data quality objective process. Here on slide 76, project planning really should follow a very simple but linear process. such as the DQO process that was originally described by the EPA, which is a seven-step process, and the Army's TPP process follows a very similar track. Worksheet 10, which is basically building of the problem statement and conceptual site model, really should always be a part of the initial discussions, as it provides the foundation for the problem statement and is really the first step of the DQO process. So Worksheet 10 is a summary of the conceptual site model and provides a review of things like past, present, and future activities and use of the site, the receptors, things like the known and suspected munitions that might have been used at the site, along with firing points and target areas. And of course, the site model may change as information becomes available, and it's updated as necessary, because of course, as the investigation progresses, we're going to get to the point where the site model is no longer conceptual. So Worksheet 11 documents the remaining DQO steps, which is steps 2 through 7, and the outputs of Worksheet 11 basically set up our sampling design and also establish the QA and QC for the project. Finally, I want to make a plug for Chapter 3 of the document. Chapter 3 has a much better overview and is a great resource for specifics on planning. You'll find a lot more information in Chapter 3 of the document for project planning. So here on slide 77, we felt a need for clarification on the differences between two key aspects that we've identified both in the ITRC document and the CLAP as well. So, and that's the difference between measurement performance criteria, or MPCs, and measurement quality objectives, or MQOs. Both MPCs and MQOs involve quality criteria, and you might be familiar with the acronym PARCS. PARCS stands for precision, accuracy, representativeness, comparability, completeness, and sensitivity, if I remember that correctly. And these are also referred to historically sometimes as data quality indicators. So MPCs are captured on AGC CLAP worksheet number 12, and these address requirements for overall project performance. And these criteria will ultimately be used to assess if the quality goals for the overall project have been met. M2Os, or measurement quality objectives, are documented in AGC CLAP Worksheet 22. And these document procedures for performing, testing, inspections, and quality control for all field data collection activities. So we can also recover from failed M2Os, and that is we have to evaluate when we fail an MQO by performing a root cause analysis and a corrective action to make sure that we're evaluating if any data could have been affected, and it must be addressed through that corrective action process. So more simply, Worksheet 12, or MPCs, are project quality criteria where the failures could really affect our ability to meet our project goals. MQOs are really targeted at field activities, and we can recover from failed MQOs. So these are really the same sort of operating practices that we use for chemical laboratories as well. Moving on to slide 78, section 432 provides quality considerations involved in site preparation activities. So on the right here, we see examples of some of the types of MQOs, like IDS accuracy and the like, that would be part of the site preparation. So things like precision accuracy of the IDS, inline spacing, completeness, and sensitivity. And all these would be associated with site preparation activities. So slide 79 is really just a screenshot. So this is a screenshot directly out of the AGC CLAP on MQOs. So what you will notice is that there are entries for defining the specific MQO, references to the specific SOP or the step where that particular activity is being used. We call those definable features of work, or DFWs. The frequency and acceptance of the acceptance criteria, who's responsible for verifying that the MQO has been met. And also, again, we can recover from failed MQOs, but we have to document that failure response, and that must be documented as part of the process. So what I have here, and if I can get the macro started here, so thank you very much. So here on slide 80, is an M2 example, and Dean showed us an example of this earlier, for representativeness and completeness in terms of site coverage. So, of course, we can't classify an item if we don't first detect it. So this pictorial is a visualization of basically a detection survey. Sometimes we call that a dynamic survey, and it's referred to as sort of mowing the lawn. And what you can see here is that the instruments, which also carry a GPS, of course, we can follow both the inline and cross track that is between row spacing to ensure that we have adequate overlap during the survey so that we potentially don't miss any items and we won't, so we have completeness. Thank you, Juliana. Okay, so I had mentioned IDS earlier, so very quickly, let me define exactly what an IDS is. So here on slide 81 is just a description of the instrument verification strip. So the IDS is another quality control metric that's used during geophysical classification investigations. The primary purpose of the IDS is really to ensure that the instrumentation is operating properly. So the IDS is evaluated typically at the start and end of each day, at least at a minimum, and consists, as you can see, of two lanes. One is a designated lane where we plant some IDS items, and these are typically either inert munitions or industry standard objects or ISOs that act as surrogates. They're spaced typically about 5 meters apart. The other lane is used to just monitor background by evaluating ambient noise. And we can set M2Os for the IDS activities as demonstrated on this next slide. So what you see here on slide 82 is that we can set and monitor acceptance criteria for both accuracy, that is the ground truth positioning accuracy, for each surrogate item in the IDS, and that's shown here on the right. And an M2O for precision can also be monitored. So on the left, we see a plot of repeated ground truth results specifically for item 4. So we can establish both accuracy and precision up front, and then we can track those throughout the investigation to make sure we're meeting those MQOs. Moving on to slide 83, the next phase of the geophysical classification process is the Q phase. So the quality considerations for the Q phase are provided in section 433 of the ITRC guide and worksheet 22-2 of the GCMR QAP. Again, you see some of the examples that we have bulletized here on the right, and it would include things like the GPS positioning benchmarks. Dean led us through earlier about making sure that we have good polarizability matches, things like representativeness of our background threshold, and also the completeness of whether we have met our seeds as well. So what exactly are seeds? So this is actually a very important aspect of a geophysical classification. Seeds play a critical role in the quality of these projects. So seeds are sort of analogous to control check samples that are performed by chemical laboratories. They're inert munition items or surrogates that are in place on site in the area that's being investigated. There are two types of seed items. QC seeds are in place by the production team, that is the folks who are actually using the instruments. And QA, we also call this validation seeds, are in place by the government or by a third party. So these seeds basically provide ongoing monitoring to ensure each step leading to the process is working. So from the detection of varied items through classification, and they're a vital part of measuring the overall success of the project. So seeds are typically placed so that about two or three are encountered each day by each acquisition team, if there's more than one team. QC seeds are sort of analogous to single blinds. And again, these are in place by the contract personnel. And they're usually placed at horizontal and vertical locations and orientations that meet or even exceed our overall performance criteria. But failure of a QC seed can be investigated and corrected by the contractor. Now, validation seeds, however, again, validation fees are in place by either the government or third party, are really sort of double blind. So the contractor has no idea where they are. Failure to detect a blind validation fee really signifies sort of a serious flaw in the investigation. It may have a negative impact on data usability. So failure of a validation fee means the team is going to have to stop work and consider which data could have been affected and determine an appropriate response if it's not detected. So validation fee failures are also monitored, by the way, for the purpose of accreditation. And they are sort of the equivalent of proficiency test samples or PT samples in the chemistry world. So passing validation fees will actually be or are a condition of accreditation for the company. So in summary, remember, QCCs are sort of single-blind checks that are in place by the contract personnel, and they're placed at depths and orientations that meet or exceed project goals. But failure of a QCC, again, can be investigated and corrected through the corrective action process. A QAC is not in place as aggressively, if you will, as QCCs, but failure of a QC or validation seed is a lot more serious and could affect the company's accreditation status. Okay, so moving on to slide 85, for the intrusive investigation identified in 434 of the ITOC document, again, we identify specific M2Os for equipment, testing, inspection, and quality control as documented in QAP worksheet 22-3. Examples are listed here on the right, such as criteria for ground truth size, and matching of targets of interest and also of non-targets of interest. And we also include a completeness check MQO via a stop dig threshold verification. So let me provide a little bit more information on that. So Dean had alluded to this earlier. So here on slide 86, once we have all the detection and classification data, the anomalies are ranked, as Dean showed you earlier, are ranked according to their match with the library. And that match metric is listed in order, and that scale you can see is on the left. The last item on the dig list targeted for removal lies on what we call this dig, no dig decision point or threshold. And it represents the item on the dig list with the least amount of certainty in terms of classification of ammunition. So as an added level of conservatism, an additional 200 threshold verification targets are intrusively investigated below the last TOI. So this is actually a verification of the threshold to protect against false negatives, isn't it? So if any of these 200 additional threshold verification targets show up to be munitions of concern, the threshold is adjusted and the process is repeated. So again, this helps us to protect against false negatives. So in addition to these 200 what we call threshold verification digs, we also have an additional 200 what we call so the 200 non-COI validation digs are performed on randomly selected non-TOIs, the rest of those items that are listed, that are on the list to be left in the ground. We randomly select 200 of those and we intrusively investigate those to make sure that the reasons we call them non-TOIs can be confirmed so that they were accurately classified as inert items. In fact, so that that is true. So this is actually a validation of the overall detection and classification process for preventing false negatives and false positives. Finally, we get asked all the time where the 200 number come from for both our stop dig threshold and the validation digs. The 200 number for both of these were just discussed and agreed upon by the IDQTF subgroup. So this is just a consensus number agreed upon by the group. There's really no statistical basis for that 200. So during geophysical classification projects, there's a lot of dynamic decision making, if you will, and there's a lot of data being generated. So how we document, manage, review, and validate data is a key part of quality consideration. So ITRC Section 435 and QAP Worksheet 29 provide minimum specifications for data management tasks. So that would be things like interim and final deliverables, procedures for controlling project documents, project records, and even databases. And its purpose is to ensure data completeness, data integrity, and also ease of retrieval. Section 436 of the ITRC document describes three basic phases of data review, and these are addressed in worksheets, AGC QAP worksheets 34 through 37. So the QAP must document the inputs needed for the appropriate data review, and that's documented in worksheet 34. Verification, which is AGC QAP 35, is a check that everything that was supposed to be done has in fact been completed as planned. And then validation in AGC QAP worksheet 36 is an evaluation of whether results conform to stated criteria as specified in the QAP during project plan. So finally, the data usability assessment, which is the last worksheet 37, basically takes all that information from the verification and validation and determines if the overall data that has been acquired supports the objectives, especially the MPCs in worksheet 12 and our data quality objectives. Have they been met so that a very quick decision can be finalized? Switching gears a little bit, a question was asked earlier about the accreditation program. So the DoD's Environmental Data Quality Work Group has developed an accreditation program, also known as DADCAP, for activities performing geophysical classification. So the accreditation program follows a similar platform that's been used for chemical laboratories using third-party accrediting bodies. The accreditation program requires analysts to have documented qualifications, training, and demonstration of their capabilities to use the instrumentation. It provides a formal recognition to competent testing organizations and a means to identify those that meet the established program requirements, the minimum program requirements. It requires successful detection and classification of validation seeds and ongoing requirements for validation seeds and act as, again, as the equivalent of proficiency test samples. The organization must meet must perform internal audits, they must have a documented corrective action process, and they also must have a documented process for processes for process improvement and prevention of reoccurrence of problems. So these are all conditions of accreditation of the DADCAP program. So overall, this helps us to enhance confidence in results by our clients, by our regulatory partners, and also by the public as well. So in summary, here on slide 89, as I discussed very earlier in this discussion, all the quality assurance and quality control steps that we normally associate with increasing confidence in data are really already built into the geophysical classification program and are summarized both in the ITRC section, section 4, and also the companion document of the AGC QAP. These instruments, just like those performing chemical analysis, have their limitations. But as long as we utilize initial project scoping and planning through the use of systematic planning and as documented in our AGC QAP, implementation of QA and QC, and together with an implementation of an accreditation program now, will help us to increase our ability to use this technology by the organizations performing the work. So collectively, these steps will produce data that meet the needs of the DoD and will also allow all our partners, including our federal and state regulatory entities, to increase our confidence in decision-making. Finally, on the last slide, 90 here, I want to bring to your attention, we actually have recently updated the last quality considerations for munitions that has recently been, it was originally went out in 2008. We just updated it. I think it's available on the website now. And you can find that document there at the URL that's listed. That's the UXO-5 document. So at any rate, I'm going to hand the baton off to my very good friend, Dr. Herb Nelson from CertUp and ESGCP, who's going to lead us through a case study. So take it, Herb.
Thank you, Ed. I appreciate it. So now is the time when we have stopped all the new learning, and it's time to start bring together everything we've talked about in the first three or four modules and apply them to an example site. So we have put together a site that is a composite of several of the ESGCP demonstration sites, and I think we've arranged it such that it will demonstrate everything that we've talked about today. So here is an overview site, overview map, excuse me, of our site. It's a relatively large site in coastal California. As you can see, the land is now owned by the university, which means it's a formerly used defense site. But one thing about university ownership is there are really no access restrictions. There's cattle grazing going on this site. Geotechnical classes do some work on this site. There's camping and hiking. So it's everybody can get access to it, so we have to be careful about the explosive hazard. Here is the historical data on this site. Like many of these sites, there were many multiple overlapping range fans over the years. The records are not very good about which ones of these are used and which ones are not used, so we have to be alive for any of those, any of these being possible. And so based on the, we've drawn an MRS based on those ranges of about 2,500 acres that we're going to take a look at. During the time since the university took over the project, took over Patterson Land, excuse me, there have been a number of UXO finds on the surface or near surface. You can see little bomb symbols there. So the Department of Defense has been out several times to handle things that have found on the surface. So we certainly know there's a live hazard on this site. And so, of course, you can't do 2,500 acres, or you can rarely afford to do 2,500 acres each at one bite at, in the way that these things are funded. So, in fact, we have money in the first year to only clear 100 acres of this site, and we've drawn a little box up here that marks the 100 acres that we're going to clean up in. So here's a very brief history of the site, and I think those of you that work on munition sites will recognize this. Established really just after World War I, greatly expanded like many of these training ranges were in World War II and the Korean War usage, and then it was transferred to these private owners. You can see there was a preliminary assessment done. I think we said somewhere earlier that the Department of Defense follows a circular process when they do munitions responses. So you can see the steps so far that have been handled at the circular process. There's also been a two time critical removal actions, and that's in response to those items that were found on the surface. And then finally, there was a remedial investigation in 2011. And I used to say when we first started this training 3 years ago that the report had just been published, but of course now time has moved on and the report was published about 3 years ago. So here is the spatial distribution of the munitions and explosives of concern based on the data from the RI. So now we have some real data. Transects were taken and extrapolated and interpolated, and you can see that there's some pretty hot spots in the middle of this site. And of course now you understand why we've chosen the 100 acres that we're going to work on. It looks like we missed some of the hot spot at the top of our site, and in fact, there's two different parcels. There's a big fence line right across the top there, and so we're doing everything south of the fence line in this first year. Ed, I talked to you in some detail, and earlier introduction, Dean talked a little bit about the depth profile of the detection. So we, as Ed said, we always want to look at a vertical distribution of the munitions that we find. And these are the data from the RI. You can see that a number of munitions were found, 37 millimeters, 60 millimeter mortars, 81 millimeter mortars, and some larger projectiles. And of course, that fits with this being a very a training range with a lot of overlapping ranges, a training area, excuse me, with a lot of overlapping ranges. So we expect to find a wide variety of things. Here's the good news, though. The deepest one we found for everything that we happened to find, you can see we didn't find everything that we expected. There was historical data on a 5-inch rocket. We didn't find any. But the deepest one we found is more shallow than our deepest detection depth. So that's a good sign. We'll have confidence that we'll be able to detect anything that's out there. And here's some even better news. There's very little soil on the top of the hills here. You can see that the bedrock is only about 2 feet down or so, a foot and a half down, maybe even a foot that's marked there down at the top of the hills. So that means the items can't get very deep, and so even the small things we can detect easily on the top of the hills. When we go down into the valleys, of course, there's a lot more topsoil over the bedrock. But even there, we only get, 3 feet deep, 3.5 feet deep, something like that. So we really, at this site, are pretty lucky. We have a natural bound on how deep the items can get. And since we know how deep we can detect things, we have good expectation that we're going to be able to have a successful cleanup here. So our remedial objective is pretty simple, and it's to detect and dispose of any MEC, or munitions and explosives of concern, that can be detected using a detection threshold aimed at finding a 37-millimeter projectile 12 inches below the ground. And, of course, to do that as efficiently as possible. So that really leads us to two things. The detection threshold for 37-millimeter projectile 12 inches tells us how sensitive we have to be. To do it as efficiently as possible tells us that we probably have to use geophysical classification because we can't spend a lot of money digging a lot of holes. And so we also, though, notice implicit in this is to remove any mech detected irrespective of depth. So even though we're going after 37 millimeters, 12 inches below the ground, if some of these larger munitions are deeper and we detect them, we want to remove them. And I've already said we want to be obviously economical and not dig a lot of holes. So we sit down and do a little projected cost, and you'll see this was done in 2015, so now it's 3 years out of date. So I'm sure all of these numbers are a little higher, but I don't really want you to focus on the exact numbers. We put a big table here, so at your leisure you can go back and look at the kind of bids you're getting for these sorts of items. But you can see for 100 acres, using, I think, pretty reasonable assumptions, using the traditional approach with no classification, there are a lot of anomalies on this site, so there's a lot of digging to do, would cost something $6.5 million or so. And we project that doing classification or geophysical classification in this case would cost $3.5 million. So we have the opportunity here to save a lot of money on this site and get move on there next year and do another 100 acres using almost the money we saved in the first year. So it's pretty easy to choose the sensor for this site. These kind of photographs never really show you the, never give you a very big, it's hard to see the slope in these kind of things. It is unobstructed sky view. You can tell it's way out in the open, but it's very steep terrain. And it's probably too steep a terrain to use a tractor towed or vehicle towed system. So in this case, we're going to use this Temtats 2x2. The commercial version of that these days is called the Metal Mapper 2x2. But since we're open and great sky view, we're going to be able to use RTK GPS, so we'll be able to get centimeter level positioning. So just like following the process that Ed laid out, we start with a planning meeting, and in our first CPP meeting, we agree on the remedial objective that I've already shown you. We agree on the survey lane spacing that we're going to have to use to achieve that remedial objective. We decide how we're going to choose anomalies. Dean walked you through, and in fact, even Fred in the beginning talked a little bit about doing a survey to find anomalies, and then we go back and maybe take Q data on the ones that we identify. We're going to cut that number down using something called informed source selection, or ISS, and I'll explain that a little later. We also agreed on the schedule. There are some threatened and endangered species on this site, so there's times that we can't work. We've got all that stuff worked at the first DPP meeting. We, of course, are going to document everything we're going to do in a quality assurance project plan. Ed has talked to you about this earlier, so you are familiar with that. I'll show you as we go along references to some of the worksheets where the things that I'm going to talk about are documented, and that'll be a repeat of what Ed showed you earlier in the last module. So here is the general workflow. Starting at the top, we've had the TPP meeting. We've prepared our QAP, so that's what we've already talked about. It gives the definable features of work, which Ed introduced earlier, that will correspond to each of these major workflow steps on the left. And then there are many, many tasks associated with each of these workflow steps, but I've picked out a few that we're going to talk about. And I've tried to list on the very right column a few of the products that you might see. And we'll talk through these products, and we'll see how to decide that they're adequate, what we might be looking for in these things. And the goal of this at the end is we've gone through this whole project in a sketch level, and we'll have seen what it looks like from beginning to end. So let's get on now. We'll start with this first task after TPP and the QAP, which is site prep. So one of the first tasks in there will be surface clearance. So there's several things that purposes this serves for us. Number one is safety, of course. We don't want any unexploded ordnance that could be triggered by somebody kicking them or driving over them on the surface when they're around doing the survey. But the second thing we want to get out of this is we get a final inventory of what might be used on the site. So we have historical records. All the items are listed in the column on the left from the conceptual site model. Do we see evidence of them then in the surface suite? You can see we see evidence of everything except for the 81-millimeter mortar. But here is the important part, the row I just highlighted. We don't find evidence of any unexpected munitions. Now, that just means we were lucky. at a site you're doing, you may find unexpected munitions. And then we would just add those to conceptual site model when we updated it and tell the analyst that we expected some different munitions. And they would obviously put that into their analysis procedures. There's also obviously doing a service clearance a big opportunity for cost savings. It costs a whole lot less to walk out on the site with a group of folks and pick up items than it does to classify them later on. So everything we can pick up at this stage is just frag and clutter, the better off we are. So the other thing that's part of site preparation is installing the seeds. Ed had talked to you some detail about this. Our contractor is going to install 37-millimeter projectiles, inert ones, of course, and small, these things that are called industry standard objects, 80 means 80 gauge. They're very good surrogates for 37-millimeter projectiles. Our contractor has chosen to install 200 QC seeds, 50% of each. The reason for this, of course, is it's very hard to come up with 200 in their 37-millimeter projectiles. And our contractor is going to place the seeds at 6 depths up to the performance work statement detection depth. So you can see we're going down to 30 centimeters. He's chosen to place them at these depths listed on the slide. And all of this, of course, is documented in worksheet 17 of the QAP. The other set of seeds that Ed talked to you about was the so-called QA seeds or government validation seeds. These are, of course, blind to the contractor. The contractor's QC seeds are blind to the field team, but known to the contractor's QC personnel. The government seeds are blind to everyone on the contractor team. The government's also going to put out about 200 seeds. We're not only going to see industry standard objects and 37-millimeter projectiles, we're also going to see some of the larger mortars. And as you can see in the third bullet on this slide, we're going to explore the full range, depth range of interest, meaning deeper depths for the larger munitions. These, of course, can't be documented in the QAP because that's available to everyone. So these are documented in the Quality Assurance Project Plan, which is only held by the government. And then one final step in site prep is setting up the IVS, the instrument verification strip. Ed talked to you about this. We're going to make sure that the sensors are working each morning before we use them. We're going to get some measurement of site noise to convince ourselves we can achieve the remedial objective. And here are the four items that our contractor put in their IVS, two of the 37-millimeter projectiles on the right and two of the small pipe sections, or ISO 80s, on the left. And so here's the first day at the IVS. The contractor runs and you can see on the right, runs three or four passes over the items that are buried on the IVS. And then off to the left of that runs one extra line for a background measurement. Step number one is, are they where we think they are? And you can see on the left-hand side of this plot is a polar plot showing the distance from where we think they are, and they're well within the 25-centimeter offset that's allowed by our QC criteria, so we're in good shape on that. You can see in that plot on the right, there's a big, healthy signal under each one of those crosses, so there's plenty of stuff there. And then, so the sensor's working, the geolocation system's working. The last thing to do is find out from the noise line on the left whether the noise is sufficiently low. So we think that on this side, we expect two different variants of these 37-millimeter projectiles. That's what the historical records tell us. And you can see the larger one has a little bit of a larger signal than the smaller one does. But we want to be able to detect these things at 30 centimeters. So that implies that we have to be able to detect something down to about 1.7 millivolts per amp. These sensors read in units of millivolts per amp. The amp is a transmit current. So we need to detect the smallest one of these things at 30 centimeters, we have to detect an amplitude that small. But as Ed Walker said to you earlier, obviously we can't have a signal noise of 1-to-1, or we'd be detecting nothing but noise peak. So we're really looking for a 5 or 6-to-1 signal to noise at that. So we would like our site noise to be a factor of 5 or 6 below this number. But on this site, it's a pretty quiet site. There's not been a lot of geology. There's not been a lot of humans out there, so there's not a lot of human-induced clutter. You can see the site noise is very low. It's more than a factor of 10 below this. So we should have no trouble meeting our remedial objective. This, of course, was our last chance to measure this. If the site noise had been much higher, then we would be in danger of not achieving our remedial objective, and we may have to go back to the site team and ask ourselves, can we work with the data we're going to get, or do we have to rethink through our remedial objective? But in this case, we're in good shape. We're ready to go. and so we're ready to go to the detection survey. So 100 acres is an awful lot to show on a plot, and you wouldn't really see anything. So what I've done here is taken just six of these little sectors or quadrants that they do in the data collection and showed them to you. And you can see the number, so there's obviously 100 or so of these things. I just picked six of them out of the middle. And I've done something where I've colored everything below the detection threshold gray and everything above it in various colors. So you can see there's a lot of detected anomalies out there. We talked about this being a pretty cluttered site in terms of munitions fragments, and obviously that's why it would cost a lot to do in a traditional method if you have to dig all of these. So I told you earlier, though, that we are going to not cue all of those. We're going to use something called informed source selection. So there's really two ways to decide which of those to detail. That plot before showed you the simplest way. Anybody that has a signal bigger than your threshold, you have to look at it. The problem is that really biases towards very small, near-surface items. Remember, Dean told you these are very, he used the word near-sighted sensors. The signal falls off as the sixth power of the distance. So little small things on the surface give a relatively large signal compared to the items that we're interested in deep. So if you use amplitude thresholds, you're really going to be looking at a lot of small surface items, which of course are not a hazard and we don't want to spend our money on. The other way are this thing called so-called informed source selection, where you don't just use the amplitude that I plotted on that last slide, but you use all the channels of data collection. Dean showed you an example with the 12 times the 4 channels. And we only flag anomalies that result from items big enough to be the smallest target of interest. In that case, here's a 37. So we discriminate against all the really small fragments that are on the surface. And I'll show you an example of this. Now I've brought this thing down to only one quarter, half in each dimension. I thought it was one quarter of one of those things I showed you before. And I put a little flag here on all of the items that are above the amplitude threshold. There's a lot. But if we use so-called informed source selection, look how many we're able to eliminate as being too small and too near the surface. So we've gotten rid of a very large fraction. And when we did this over the entire site, we got rid of about 50% of the anomalies. So we were able to take them off the list because they're way too small to be a 37 millimeter. So there are obviously a number of QC checks at every one of these steps. We're in the detection survey. One of the QC steps is to make sure that we detect all of the QC seeds within, in this case, 40 centimeters of their known location. And mostly this looks good in this polar plot, but if you look carefully, there's one up there in the top left that's outside of the 40 centimeter threshold. Remember, Ed told you that you can recover from errors in QC seeds. We can go back and look at our procedures and find out what's going on. And when we did that, it turns out this is, remember I told you it's a very steeply sloped site. When we did that, it turns out that the instrument that detects the slope and so corrects for the slope was not recording this day. And so the thing is in the wrong spot. So obviously that means we have to lose a whole day's worth of data. But now we have a check each morning to make sure that the tilt meter is working. We go back and recollect those data, that thing moves right back into spec. So this is actually should be called a QC success, not a QC failure, because it brought out a problem we had, we corrected it, and we're able to move on. So this 40 centimeters, of course, would be found in the worksheet 22 of the RIPD. Okay, so now we've got our detections. Now we just go into queue data. As Dean showed you a picture before of people going from flag to flag to flag. Obviously, if you look at the picture on the left, we have a lot fewer flags than we would if we had done everything, and that's where ISS has gotten us. But we just go to each of those and take queued measurements over each one, and you can see we're just accumulating them in the library on the computer that's running the thing on the right. I highlight, though, background measurements. You can see they're called backgrounds, because this SBG stands for static background. Our QC requirement is that we take one of these backgrounds every 2 hours. They are going out there with the idea of taking it once each hour, so that as the background varies or the water on the ground varies or something, we can correct correctly. You can see they missed their background, their 1 hour by about 5 minutes, but they're well within the 2 hours. So we just do this now over the whole site, collect these data over each one, and then we can move on to an analysis, which is the next step, as you see on the left. So one of the things we do, a QC step during that data collection for the queued data, is also look at how well we're doing with the seeds. In this case, now we want to do two things. We want to make sure the seeds are, we're finding the seeds in the correct location. Queued data are much more precise than dynamic data, so we've brought now the specification down to 25 centimeters, and you can see we make that easily. Almost everybody's within 10 centimeters, and that's about how well you can locate them. So we really know where these targets are. And then the second half of this, of course, is anything that is a munition or munition surrogate better end up on the list to be dug, or we're not doing a good process. And I'll show you that later. Okay, so Dean talked to you about clusters, and of course we'll find some of those out here. Repeating again, we really need a better word for cluster because it does make you think that they're located near each other on the surface. But what we mean is they're located near each other in this space of polarizabilities. And so here was a cluster that had a very high match. If you look at it, you can see there's one large polarizability, two small and smaller and pretty equal. So this is varying munitions looking like. So we go dig up one of those, and then we dug the one that's in blue, and we find out that it's a 37. So that's good. So obviously we were going to dig all of those from the library match, but also from cluster analysis we dig all of those. We have another cluster that has 41 matches in it, and you can see it's also one large and two small polarizabilities, but the two small, if you look at the blue line, which is just one of the items, they vary by a little bit. They're not quite symmetric, but it's still got a very high match, so we need to go check one of these out. And when we check this out, you can see it's a Benna piece of metal just about the size of a 37. So the sizes all match, but the symmetry doesn't, which is why the two polarizabilities aren't the same, the two smaller polarizabilities. So these we can call fragments, and we can now put them not on the list to be done. And we do that through all the clusters. We match everything against the library, as Dean described, and Ed talked a little bit about in the last talk. And we get this list of all 25,000 anomalies that we took queued measurements over. So this took a number of weeks to do this, even with multiple sensors out there. And you can see we make a plot of the decision statistic, as Dean described it, how well it matches the library versus anomaly number. And you can see that a number of them match quite well. But we draw in general, this is from experience and from tests at the site, you can see that we say you need to have an anomaly match number of about 0.85 to be confidently ranked as a munition. So we've really gotten rid of a very large number of these items, and only thinking about a little less than 3,000 out of the 25,000 have to be investigated. But it's actually even better news than that, because if you remember, we got rid of 26 or 7,000 in this informed source selection project. So this shows you the ability to save money on the site. Instead of digging 51 or 52,000 items, we think we only have to dig 3,000. Okay, so let's go back and look now at what we're doing when we continue on. So here's our ranked anomaly list, and here it is blown up at the bottom, only looking on the ones that have fits above 0.85. We go out and dig them all. Now we're into the intrusive investigation part of this thing, and you can see I've marked them. The ones that were targets of interest, I've marked with the red color, and the ones that are clutter are marked with a green color. So you can see that in the beginning, almost all of them, the really high matches, the 0.99, the 0.98, those are almost all targets of interest, which is what we expect. And as we go to the right, we're getting fewer and fewer targets of interest, more and more of its clutter that looks like targets of interest, but we're still getting targets of interest out to our threshold. So the question is, are we done? One thing we want to do to think about whether we're done or not is look at where the seeds are. And so now I've marked what were the seeded items, both QA and QC seeds. And you can see two things out of this. The distribution of the seeds looks a lot like the distribution of the regular targets of interest. So that means we did a good job on our seeds. They're no easier to detect than normal targets of interest, and they're no harder to detect. And we don't want either of those to happen. We don't want our digging driven by the seeds, but we also don't want them so easy that they're not providing a good test of our system. So we're happy with our seeds. We think the contractor says they're done, So now we go into the stuff, the checks that Ed has talked about. Check number one, were all recovered items consistent with what the analyst predicted? We don't want to just be lucky here and have dug them up. We want to have dug them up for a reason, and they match that reason. So obviously the analyst will look at every single one of these 2,800 items that came out of the ground and match them up with what they did, what they predicted. We don't have time for that, so we're just going to look at a few. So let's pick that anomaly right there, which is up in the very high. So that should be a bang-on match or ammunition. Here are the polarizability curves, and behind it, the library curves for a 60-millimeter body, meaning the fins have gotten knocked off. And you can see it's a very high match. And when we dig it up, that's what it is. It's got a funny shadow at the top, the way they photographed it, but it's a 60-millimeter body. So, good. We feel good about that. Let's go to a couple more that are down, not as high a match metric, still a very high one, but sort of almost at the knee of that curve. Here's the first one. It matches extremely well to a small ISO 80, which is, of course, why we dug it up. It's not. It's a piece of clutter that's just about the size and just about the thickness of an ISO 80. So, of course, we don't feel bad about digging this up. I mean, we wish the systems were better and we didn't have to dig this up, but it's the price of doing business. We can't eliminate this. It's not, it is in line with what we expected it to be. It's just slightly different. The other one matches very well also to a 6mm body, but you can see the top curve, the red one, is a little bit off, so it's not a perfect match, and that's why it gets a 0.98 ranking. And when we dig it up, it's a 60mm body, but it's got a little hunk out of it. And so you can see we don't have to be a complete munition to get it correctly. Those little hunks are what give you the difference between a 0.99 to a 0.98. But remember, we dig up down to 0.85. So we're quite comfortable that everything we dug is as described. So now we go into Ed's final two verification validation things. Number one, we want to verify the stop nick threshold at digging past the last target of interest. And as Ed told you, we agreed on 200 items past the last target of interest at the TPP meeting. The contractor already was very relatively conservative. It dug 120 past the last TOI. So we only need to dig 80 more. So we dig 80 more, and we don't find any TOI. Obviously, if we did find a TOI, we'd reset the thing and try again. But now we can be confident that we have correctly classified them, and there are no more TOI left. And then the final thing is to validate the whole process to make sure that the items we're leaving in the ground will match the reason that we left them at the ground. And so as Ed said, among all those other items, we randomly select 200, and I just did this in Excel. I put a random number next to all the items and picked the 200 highest, so you can see they're sort of distributed along the whole curve. Dig them up, and then we want to make sure, and while we're digging them up, the analyst answers the question, why did you leave this in the ground? Now, most of the time, the answer to that question will be because it's too small. And that's because most things on a munition site are small fragments from the explosions and are too small. But in some cases, the answer to that question will be because it's flat or because it's not symmetric enough to be a munition. And we want to bring all of these 200 back, match it up against the analyst's reason for leaving them in the ground, and make sure they match. We're in good shape in this case because they did match. So we can declare the intrusive part of the investigation over. And now we want to come back and do our after-action vertical conceptual site model. And this is another way we'll convince ourselves that we got everything off the site. You can see in this case I've plotted the seated items and the range of their depths in those gray bars. The items that we found that matched them, so the 81-millimeter mortars, the 60-millimeter mortars, the 4.2-inch rockets that we either seeded or dug up that were native, and a little star by the deepest one. So there's lots of good things on this plot. We seeded as deeply as anything we found, and in most cases we seeded deeper than we found the deepest item, so that makes us feel good that we can find them. The deepest item was far short of our detection depth, so we have confidence that we can detect below where we found any item. So at the end of this thing, we get back together with the site team, and we've got everybody happy. The state PM is happy because the project, this 100 acres, is over, and we can start marking our way through cleaning this site. The DOD PM is maybe happier because we saved a whole lot of money doing it. The taxpayer, of course, is also happy because we saved a whole lot of money doing it. the landowner who just wants us out of there so they can get back to their cattle is just happy that we got it done quickly and are ready to move on. So we'll call this a successful project, and I will turn it back over to Fred to wrap up.
Hey, thanks, Herb. And Julianne, I'm going to have you operate the slides from here on out because I'm on a slow internet connection. So before we wrap up, here's a couple more questions. Now that you've heard about it and seen the magnitude of the munitions problem, how many sites do you know of, everybody on this call, where this might be used? Some states like Alaska and Texas have over 300 sites each. California has over 600. So we don't expect you to know about every one of those sites, but we'd really like to know if this training is getting the word out to enough of these cleanup teams. And then our last question there is, have we convinced you? Would you recommend this at your site?
So Fred, we have some answers coming in, and right now most people are saying 3 to 5 sites, and that's followed closely by 1 to 2 sites. And then, would you recommend geophysical classification? It's looking like yes, I would consider it, is by far the most popular answer.
Wow, awesome. Well, so we've done our job then, guys. So now let's wrap up so you guys can start using what you learned. So at the beginning of the training, I described the problem, 5,200 sites across the country that'll take until the next century to clean up. With this new technology that we described, we can pick out just the things that are hazardous and dig them up. A lot of the harmless metal can be left in the ground. That's what this new technology will allow us to do. Dean took you under the hood, so you've seen how it works. You've learned that this technology is extremely good at finding what we're looking for, but it requires a rigorous quality approach with quality checks and controls at every step. Properly applied, our target quality standards, 100% of seeds detected. That's not bad. That's a very high standard, and we can be confident in the results. Ed Walker from California showed you how you need to know your site and you need to know what you're likely to find there. But pretty much anything you can do with a single-axis sensor, you probably can do it better with one of these new multi-axis units. Ed Coral showed you the quality assurance project plan, and that UFP QAF is a great roadmap for your project. Gives you a good template, and if you follow that the way it's written, it'll definitely help you manage your project. Ed also discussed the accreditation program for companies who use the technology and the strict controls on the source data that's used to make decisions. And again, that just gives you confidence in the results. Then in the case study that Herb presented, we saw how these sensors will be deployed at sites like the ones you might be working on. We gave you links to other resources, and here those links are again. And finally, I was asked to replay that slide I showed you earlier. Savings using this more advanced detection technology will amount to billions of dollars. We'll spend a lot more on technology and quality checks, but we'll go over each site and each object with a lot more sensors, and we'll prove at each step of the way how we found exactly the items we were looking for and only left the clutter and the fragments in the ground. I'm on the last slide now, Julianne. From today's training, you now understand the technology. You understand that to a single-axis sensor, the clutter on the left looks just like the bomb on the right. But a multi-axis sensor can tell you which one looks like a bomb. You learned how to evaluate advanced sensor technology for use on your site. You've learned some of our technology, our terminology and acronyms, TOI, non-TOI, things like that. We showed you how you can use multi-axis sensors to make decisions that leave non-hazardous items in the ground. And we've given you tools to share information with your organization and to stakeholders. The ITRC web-based guidance document is a good way to learn more, and it's a reference for you to go back to when you start managing projects using this technology. You'll find lots of great tips on site evaluations, planning material for meetings, and tools for communicating the technology to others. There's links to lots of case studies covering many types of sites, and there's more coming in all the time. And I'll leave you with this. Think about the sites you'll be working on over the next year.
If you're working on a site where single axis sensors are proposed or being deployed or maybe have been deployed in the past and everybody's used to them, follow the links to this guidance and at least evaluate whether a multi-axis sensor might be more efficient for that site. If it looks like a fit, then look further into the ITRC guidance for the tools to communicate the technology to decision makers for your project. And now let's answer some of your questions. Back over to you, Juliana.
Thank you, Fred. We do now have almost 10 minutes for your questions, so you are welcome to send those in using the Q&A in the lower right. You're also, if you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute. You are welcome to jump in with a question. And I do have a final poll for us as we're wrapping up today. Thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? Before we get to those questions, I do want to point out our links to additional resources. And this is a web page where we've gathered the links that we've talked about today, so you're welcome to keep this as a resource and use it after today's training class. Also, a reminder to everyone, we really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes now to fill out the feedback form. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate. So if that's something that you can use, be sure and check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the feedback system will generate that certificate for you. A couple of questions have come in. Do we have the percent slopes for the example site where the metal mapper was used?
Yeah, it's about 20% in the steepest part, obviously right up on the top of the hills and right in the bottom of the valley is not, but the sides of the hills were about 20%. It obviously, I'm not a safety person. It would be a little skittish to me to be driving a tractor side slope on that, but it was no problem walking, although the fellows pushing it, as you might have noticed in those pictures, were pretty beefy guys. I'd have probably been whipped by the end of the day, but I'm not that good of a field person.
Another question came in. Can you please clarify the decision process regarding placing all QC detection seeds? Do you do that to the depth of the detection per IVS, and is that required to achieve DQOs, or do you place them at variable depths in the production area?
Well, that's really something that the site, Ed, were you trying to answer that?
No, go ahead, Herb. I think you were going to answer it the same way.
Okay, yeah, that's something really that the site team would agree on at the TPP. The guidance that's recommended in the QC, in the QAP template is that the QC seeds, which are recoverable if something goes wrong, should be biased down toward the remedial objective. And the contractor then can use that to prove to themselves and to us that they can achieve the detection depth. The QA seeds or the validation seeds are not placed at depth in general or placed some sort of mid-depth where the signature is strong because that's not really recoverable if there's a failure there. So we want to make sure that they're not inadvertently put too deep or something. We want them to be a process check. But the contractor and a wise contractor should put most of their QC seeds pretty deep. You can see that our contractor at the example site did not put them all down toward the depth. So I would say that might not have been the wisest choice, but they got away with it.
Yeah, and Herb, this is Ed, just to add on to that. So typically both the QC and the QA seeds are typically placed at variable depths because they're supposed to be blind seeds. And then relative to the IVS, just as a point of clarification, the purpose of the items in the IVS is really just to verify that the instrument is working properly. So those typically are not placed at depth, and they're typically not placed at variable depth.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Ed, and I'm sorry, I should have made that in the answer. So you notice the IVS has only 4 items in this case. There's certainly not enough there to determine anything like a detection depth, but you don't need to because there's been hundreds of measurements throughout these experiments. So the detection depth of these instruments is very well understood. The only thing is the signal that an instrument will give for an item at a specified depth is very well understood. The only thing that's not known is the noise at your site, since detection is a signal or noise issue. So once you measure the noise at your site, you can very accurately predict where you can detect each condition.
Do Do we have any kind of data on sites with variable geologic conditions? For example, are multiple background measuring locations required?
Well, that certainly can be the case. We have done some stuff in the foothills of California where the background varied a lot across the site, and I'm sure there are other places, certainly in the Hawaiian Islands, there's places like that. And so there may be that. So one IBS may not do it. Here's where you win, though. You can also determine the background from the dynamic survey. So even if you get out and you get yourself into an area where the background is much higher than you expected, you'll know that. And you won't blindly say, gosh, we could meet the remedial objective down in the bottom of the valley where all the iron-containing minerals have gotten. So you might, in that case, make a plot of where we can meet our original remedial objectives and where we can't, and then the site team would make a decision. Or you may find that you can, like in our case, easily meet the objective in the easy spots and just meet it in the hard spots. But you'll know that before the team leaves the site, before you finish surveying, all that will be known.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit more about this new document that the team put together?
Dean, that may be a best you question, huh?
No, I don't think that's for me. I think the question refers to the newest quality, the second
does.
Team.
Is that... Don't you remember that you weren't a member of the new team?
Well, no, only at the very, very end. I not enough to intelligently respond to that.
So it probably turns out that you're asking the wrong group of folks. We were all members of the team before this. Each of us had a small hand to play in the new team, but it was a different set of team leads and a fairly different set of state members. So I think you're going to hang on for the training, which I understand is right after the first of the fiscal year. Joanna may know that better, but I think it's scheduled for right after the first of the calendar year.
It is coming soon. So for our participants today, keep an eye on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org, for more information about that new training class. We are out of questions for now, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. If you have a question that you haven't been able to get in or you have a follow-up question, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll follow up with trainers. For today's class, I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If you haven't already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. More information about ITRC is available on the website, which is itrcweb.org.